people pay good money to see this movie. When they go out to a theater, they want cold sodas, hot popcorn, and no monsters in the projection booth.
Everyone pretend podcasting isn't boring.
Turn it off.
I'm about to introduce you to a lady in a frenzy.
My God, the tie!
The dictionary defines frenzy as a state of wild emotional excitement. I will not quarrel with the dictionary. Actually, the motion picture frenzy is unique in its choice of a murder weapon. The murderer uses neckties to strangle his pretty lady victims. As you might expect, Scotland Yard finds itself tied in knots. The dictionary tells us that it is possible to frenzy a person. We hope to frenzy you in our little exercise in love and strangulation. Oh yes, frenzy is rated R, under 17, not admitted without parents.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me is Mr. Ian Cooper.
Hi, Mike. I'm positively glutinous with self-approbation.
Also joining us is Ms. Rebecca McCallum.
What about coming up, then?
This week, we are discussing one of Alfred Hitchcock's later works and his final British film, Frenzy. The film stars John Finch as Richard Blaney and Barry Foster as Robert Rusk. They are a couple of blokes in a swinging London that is plagued by a murderer of women, the necktie murderer. We will be spoiling this film as we go ahead, so if you don't want anything ruined, turn off the podcast and come on back after you've seen the movie. We will still be here. Ian, when was the first time you saw Frenzy and what did you think?
I saw it on TV in what must have been one of the earliest screenings, the late 70s, and it freaked me out completely. I really enjoyed it, but I think because I'd not seen Straw Dogs or The Devils or any of those kind of films from around the same period, it really, really freaked me out, even though I suspect it had been cut. It had quite an impact on me, but I loved it.
And Rebecca, how about yourself?
Yeah, I was in my early 20s when I saw this, and I don't know if it's something to do with it being a later entry in the Hitchcock canon, but the older I get, the more I find myself coming back to this film. And like Ian, I remember feeling shocked at the violence and even the vocabulary, the language in this film, there's a crudeness to it that I hadn't really seen in Hitchcock before. And I think as well, there is also to speak to that difference, but also to speak to a lot of those like signature things that we recognize in Hitchcock, I see here as well, but just with that slight rougher edge. This is a very nihilistic film, I think. It contains humour, for sure, but not a lot of positive things happening for women in this film, and not enough really to temper that overall kind of hopeless feeling that I really feel this film carries. And this is real, like a culmination of a lot of the themes that we've seen in Hitchcock's career from, you know, The Wrong Man, and I'm sure we'll talk more about things like The Lodger and Strangers on a Train and those exchanges of killings I see there as well. But also like the use of like non-stars this time and Hitchcock choosing not to go down that path, and this return to London as well being important and him not wanting to avoid those cliches, I think. So, and I'm also interested in how this film builds on Hitchcock's interest in audience complicity as well, and those uncomfortable spaces that he likes to put us in.
Yeah, I remember renting this on VHS back in, it's probably like 92, 93, somewhere around there. And I had taken some Hitchcock classes. I was in film school at the time, but this was not one that was shown in the Hitchcock canon. You know, you saw Dial M for Murder and North by Northwest, Psycho, of course. Yeah, we watched The Lodger, but this was not something that we were shown. And I was pretty taken aback by it, just to see the level of violence, the nudity that was in here, and not really realizing like, oh, well, this, you know, this is coming after not just Hitchcock's work, but after, you know, the whole cycle of the Italian giallos and things, where it's like, oh, we're taking these kind of things that Hitchcock gave us and elevating them even more and making them even more outrageous. The thing I remember the most is the potato truck scene, and we'll definitely talk about that. But that was the one that stuck with me the most when I went back to rewatch this for this podcast. Couldn't remember very much at all, but I was very pleased by what I saw and very happy with just some of the things that he was doing with the camera, of course. You know, this is Hitchcock, and some of the things that he had done before but was taking to another level in this one. And, of course, we'll be discussing that as we go along. One of the things that stood out for me with this viewing was going back and watching the trailer and seeing just how similar the trailer for this one was to Psycho and the way that he was kind of taking us through all of these different locations and playing upon his own stardom, of course, because, you know, this is Alfred Hitchcock of 1972. Everybody knows what they're getting, quote unquote, with a Hitchcock film at this point.
Yeah, and Hitchcock being, you know, 70 plus at this point as well, I think, and just being able to demonstrate his mastery. And I think, to your point about the trailer, I think being able to look at that as well and how that feeds into readings of the film, because Hitchcock trailers and his promotional materials are all part of the fabric of his art, aren't they? We can talk about Hitchcock and what this film might mean in his career maybe in a moment, but it opens the trailer with him floating in the river, and it's like this idea of him kind of being playing at being dead almost, but having a religious connotation as well, and him, you know, speaking to this idea of rivers and like rivers as being like, or what they should be, like cleansing, purifying, you know, sources. But here they're muddy, they're brown, and he does that corruption in Psycho as well. And just how he shows us those key beats, and like you said, the title so representative of Psycho. And but then we do have that humour, but then there's also that real darkness in the trailer when he makes the dry joke about Babs and her wearing his tie, and he takes it off the body and he puts it on, and he asks us, so we're invited into this trailer, you know, how do you like my tie? So to me, this is really bold. It's very dark. And again, it just positions him, or seeks to position him slash align him with the murderer of the film.
Yeah, and we got to see him, put him in that position of, is Alfred Hitchcock himself a murderer? We would see that so often in things like the Alfred Hitchcock Hour or Alfred Hitchcock Presents, where he's there with all of these tools of destruction, you know, him doing the exercises, but then you find out that he's pulling the blade up and down on a guillotine, you know, these things where it's just like him having this whole thing where he wants to murder the sponsors of the show, and just this, like, not back and forth, but just it was always him introducing the commercials and just talking about, you know, like, oh, here we go again. Here's the sponsors. And wouldn't it be great if they were just all dead? It's like, all right. But yeah, putting himself in that position of both victim in the river as well as potential murderer, where, you know, hey, yeah, how do you like my tie? And then her reaction, oh, my God, the tie. Pretty clever stuff, though.
With the potato truck also in the trailer with the kind of glee. He talks about these dead women. When a guy called James Allardyce was hired to write the links for Alfred Hitchcock Presents, and one of the notes he was given was, quote, Hitchcock is very objective towards death. Dead bodies are not necessarily sacred to him. And that kind of understates just how playful the attitude is to dead bodies. And obviously in the trailer for Frenzy, it's dead female bodies. Now, there's this kind of, yeah, glee in corpses. Yeah.
Now, Ian, I read your book about Frenzy and some of the stuff about how long it took for this project to gestate. I really was not familiar with that. Can you talk a little bit about how this project started and changed over the years?
Originally, as I'm sure everybody knows, Hitchcock was interested in serial murder, going right back to The Lodger. And he had the idea in the early 60s of writing a film from the point of view of a serial killer. And a treatment was actually registered with the Writers Guild in 1964. The treatment references Shadow of the Doubt, and it's almost sounds like it's going to be a prequel to that, you know, Uncle Charlie, the serial killer. And over the years, Hitchcock approached various writers, Robert Bloch, Ben Levy, Howard Fast, who wrote the Spartacus novel, about working on this. And he worked on this idea for a long time, for a film that was going to be called Kaleidoscope Frenzy, which is a notably kind of groovy title. And it would have been very different to anything in the Hitchcock era. it was going to be the story of Willie Cooper, no relation, a gay bodybuilder with a mother fixation, obviously, who murders a woman in Central Park and then becomes involved with this female cop who's trying to investigate the murder. Well, what would have been really notable about it was Hitchcock was very envious of like Antonioni and Buñuel and all European directors and the freedom they had. And so he planned things like a 360-degree and really, really striking colour scheme. There's all sorts of reasons why it didn't happen. One was he ran the script past Truffaut, who said it was banal. I mean, the stills from it make it look fantastic. It looks like Zabriskie Point or something with all these kind of really, you know, these sort of hippie-ish, fashionably skinny young people in various states of undress. But also MCA, who were in charge of Universal, hated it. They called the villain impossibly ugly. I say this in the book, and I love this story, that Hitchcock never forgot this. During the making of Family Plot, his last film, there's a bit with the garage, and somebody suggested there'd be graffiti on the garage. And somebody said, what's it going to say? And Hitchcock said, fuck MCA. He was obviously still, all these years later, angry that his... I was going to say this wildly different project, but obviously it wouldn't have been. It would have been experimental, and so was Psycho, and so was Rope. And, you know, this constant experimentation is there in Hitchcock anyway. But it would have been... It sort of anticipates Frenzy very much because, as Rebecca was saying, it's this kind of... It would have been quite an ugly film. Not only ugly characters, but no stars, no Grace Kelly, no Montgomery Clift. You know, it would be these kind of average-looking people in quite an ugly part of New York. And weirdly, what struck me when you were talking about the Thames, quite a lot of the scenes took place in the Hudson River. So you do have this idea that, you know, the river and subverting that already. So elements of it do turn up in Frenzy, but it's one of those great what-ifs in filmmaking, I think.
Yeah, even when you bring that up, I'm thinking immediately of the, was it the garbage bag killer from Cruising, which is 8 years later, yeah, but it almost, there's with the gayness and this stuff, it kind of recalls that as well. That's funny.
Yeah, and it would have been really frightening. There's a bit where the character Willie's mother walks in on him masturbating. You know, he was trying to push the envelope in a way that we see again in Frenzy. But also, yeah, that's, you know, Janet Leigh in her underwear in Psycho, there's always this sense of pushing against censorship in Hitchcock. But I think it would have been too, he would have gone too far too fast for the people financing his films, essentially.
The opening credits of this movie, we have a treatment for the title. We have this kind of stripes on the word Frenzy, but we don't get that for the rest of the titles. Like when you mentioned Psycho, Psycho's very famous for its opening credits and the way that the words will kind of build and shift in these things. So you have the treatment throughout the entire credit sequence, whereas with Frenzy, it feels like just normal credits until you get to the title, and then it's got that treatment to it. Is there a reason why he wouldn't do that for the entire title sequence, or was that just didn't want to do it?
It's funny, until you said that, I hadn't really noticed. Apart from the title and the black smoke we see in the, you know, the end of the tracking shot, it's a really playful opening sequence. That hadn't actually occurred to me. That's this jarring note in this otherwise, I mean, it could be the opening to any other swinging London or slightly unswinging London movie.
Yeah, I said swinging London, but really, we don't see the nightlife. We don't see the things that would make this swinging London. It's, yeah, it is pretty staid overall.
First of all, the Ron Goodwin score and this kind of regalness to it. It's very patriotic sounding. And it, for me, it kind of lulls us into this false sense of what we are about to see. We spoke just before about expect and being able to expect with Hitchcock. But I think what he's so good at is subverting that and, you know, putting us in one place and then actually, oh, we find that we're somewhere different. And this like ultimate God's eye view shot that we get, which we often talk about in Hitchcock, that denotes fate. And we'll see that again with Blaney when he's walking through Covent Garden, and this suggestion that he is at the mercy of a higher power. And these shots as well talk into suspense. And if we think about suspense and those shots, we are literally hanging as though hanging in suspense. So I like that. And I also think Hitchcock's playing about with, you know, the idea of what's on the surface and what lies beneath as well with this opening. As we descend and we pass through Tower Bridge, we, like Ian said, what really struck me is that pollution that's streaming from, there's a factory in the distance, I think, first, and then we see the ship with the black smoke that's protruding from it, that puts me in mind of the train of Uncle Charlie arriving in Shadow of a Doubt, you know, and then on the ship in I Confess when Father Logan and Ruth meet in secret. So we've got all those themes going on as well. And it's just such a fantastic opening. To me, it's Hitchcock saying, oh, this is what you think you're going to get. And, you know, this is where I'm going to take you. And of course, where he's taken us is back home.
That very opening shot where it has the, it's like a seal in the upper right-hand corner that has, it says London. It very much looks like you're looking at a postcard or something. So I suppose it does make sense that it would be normal credits through that whole sequence as we're flying through and the bridge is opening and we're moving through this whole space. And then you get to the very end and then, yeah, it does kind of hit you in the face that this is not what you're expecting with that title card, with Frenzy written that way, I suppose. And then that great way that, I don't know if we've moved from the helicopter to a crane or something at the end, because we are getting a pretty steady shot of this gentleman who's addressing this crowd and talking about the pollution that we've been bringing up and talking about how, you know, we're going to have clean water and things are going to be better. And, you know, this is 1972. This is right around the time of, like, you know, the first Earth Day and just the actual environmental movement is starting to kick up, and we're realizing how much we're polluting the rivers. I'm sure you guys didn't see the famous commercial we had in the United States where it was a Native American gentleman crying at all of the pollution that he sees around, right? And then the joke of it is, oh, the river is polluted with a dead body. When we get that shot of the naked dead body in the river with the tie, and then the gentleman who, I believe it's the guy who is giving the speech, is like, oh, is that my club tie? So you immediately start to think about higher versus lower as far as class, and we're going to play with that through this entire film.
Hitchcock, being a Londoner, I mean, there is this strange thing about the Thames anyway. They do find a body a week in there still. It's quite a well-known sort of suicide spot. And also, I'm not sure, certainly the Arthur Le Bourne novel, Goodbye, Piccadilly, Farewell, Leicester Square, seems to be quite heavily influenced by the London nude murders, which took place in 64, 65, maybe earlier. The series of serial killings, he was never caught, the nude murderer, but he was dumping bodies in and around the Thames. And I often think watching, they've been largely forgotten now, but I think audiences watching it then, only a few years after, will have had this extra kind of frisson seeing this. Obviously, the nude murders were about the bodies were naked. It's shocking, and I'm not sure if it might not be more shocking then with the idea of these murders still fresh in people's minds.
I'd like to talk more about representations of female characters as we go along, and I'm sure there'll be plenty of opportunity, but I think it's worth noting at this point that this is the first female victim of the film, and she is anonymous as well, so she's not known to us, she's not given an identity. And I think as much as we can see the humour and the jokes in this scene, there's also an indignity as well to the female body that's just floating in the water naked. You know, there's no consent in death. She becomes really the subject of the gaze of the crowd here. And it's interesting how the conversation within the crowd becomes like instantly minimizing, and they miss the weight of this crime. You know, there's half jokes about Jack the Ripper, and then that's not my club tie. So they're turning it inwards on themselves. So I just think immediately this is a portrait of a very self-interested, nihilistic London.
When I'm trying to remember, you mentioned The Lodger earlier, and I'm trying to remember Hitchcock's cameo in The Lodger. Wasn't he part of a crowd kind of like this one? Because he's also in this crowd listening to this person speak, though he is not applauding. Of all the people, everyone is applauding around him, but he just seems completely still and almost draws more attention to himself by not participating.
I think in The Lodger, Hitchcock's cameo was Ian. The way I remember it is him in like the press office, so in like the hub of all these communications going out. That's how I remember it, at least.
I do remember there's bodies in the river, though, in The Lodger. So there is the sense coming full circle. But I don't remember the cameo, no.
I think people often mistake at the end when the mob are coming for The Lodger. I think there's often talk that, oh, Hitchcock might be one of those people, but I don't know if that's actually being like verified. But to this cameo, yeah, we've got him, like, to begin with, he's sort of resting on the wall, looking out pensively. But then in the second shot, which is more interesting to me, he's placed within the crowd. And to me, this is some kind of, got to be some kind of commentary on him demonstrating an alliance with his audience, which he was always so conscious of, wasn't he? And it just maybe being a commentary on him as both an insider and an outsider.
I should also mention that the music that plays over this helicopter shot, very regal, kind of reminds me of Elgar or, you know, some of these more upstanding composers that we have. And then to find out that this wasn't the original music for this, that Henry Mancini had, I think he completed the entire score before he got removed, or did he only do part of it?
I don't know. You can see bits of it. You can see the opening with the Mancini score on YouTube, but it is really good. I mean, it's a great score, but it's very much a conventional thriller score. Not that sort of the bombastic, because Ron Goodwin had scored the Battle of Britain not long before, and it feels like it's of a piece with that. So, yeah, I don't think Mancini was very happy that Hitchcock scrapped. He was basically a Hitchcockian score, and I don't think that's what Hitchcock wanted.
Yeah, that famous line of, if I wanted Bernard Herrmann, I would have gotten Bernard Herrmann, though they had split up, what, 2-3 films before this?
And I think Herrmann actually came up with that line. Try to find out who said it. It seems like it was actually Herrmann who said it.
But yeah, we are immediately wrong-footed, going from the tie of the woman who's in the river to cut to John Finch putting on a tie. And we are just throughout this entire first act being wrong-footed, being told through all of these visual cues and clues that this is our murderer that we're looking at. And John Finch does nothing to dissuade us of that opinion, because he plays this role at 11 throughout the entire movie. He is just over the top when it comes to anger. And, you know, there's one moment in a few minutes where he's going to be at lunch and he crushes a glass in his hand and cuts his hand. It's just like, this guy is way over the top. And I really like John Finch, and I kind of admire what he's doing with this. But at the same time, it's like, okay, you know, even watching this with my wife again the other day, she's just like, there's no way this guy's the killer. And I'm like, yeah, exactly. It's like, she's like, he's laying it on way too thick. I'm like, yes, I completely agree with you.
He's so unpleasant. And it's funny, because when you compare it to his performance in Polanski's Macbeth, his Macbeth is much more sympathetic, even though, you know, he kills multiple people, than he is in Frenzy. He's so horrible. And I sort of think in, you know, there's a bit of that in Psycho that Norman is very sympathetic and Sam Loomis isn't. But this is, it's like he's playing with that, but to the degree that he's just awful. And it does make you wonder why these seemingly, you know, appealing women would have anything to do with it. I mean, the way he reacts later on with the Hetty and Johnny characters, he's just so unpleasant in every way that he's directed to be like that. I know him and Hitchcock didn't really get on, but it's every time I see it, I mean, I saw it again a couple of days ago, I'm always amazed at that. You know, that it's, how did he direct it? You know, be more horrible, be more unpleasant.
Yeah, if you had told me that Finch was drunk through this entire performance, I would have believed you, but I don't think he was. We should also talk real quick, just take a little pit stop here as far as the names in this movie, because it almost feels like we are reading a Marvel comic book here with some of these names. We've got Robert Rusk, Brenda Blaney, Felix Forsyth, you know, they all have these alliterative names, and then have Richard Blaney and Robert Rusk as our two main male characters. I was just losing my shit as I was going through and writing my notes and just like, wait, is this Richard or is this Robert? And I'm like, I know he wants us to confuse these names, though they do use the nicknames for these folks very often. It's much more Dickie and Bob rather than Richard and Robert. But man, oh man, it was tough for me to keep these guys straight in my notes.
It's actually worse in the book, because in the book, his name's Blaney with an M and his nickname is Blameworthy. So it's like Dan was trying to push the wrong man thing. And Bob Rusk's character's nickname is The Biscuit. I don't know if that translates at all, you know, because Rusks were a popular kid snack. So he is annoying, but the book, it's much worse. I mean, Blaney.
And he only eats red herrings for lunch, right? Yeah, he's so intense in this, and everything is being handed to us as far as like, oh, it's this guy. He's fired almost immediately. He works at a bar and he's pinching the booze, and Felix's boss is not very happy about that. Then we do have Anna Massey in here, and I always love seeing her show up in things. At one point, she's talking, I believe, about Felix, and she says, he's always fingering me. I have a notion of what that means, but does that mean something else in Britain?
It can do. I think there's definitely a double meaning. Often, it would mean, certainly when I was a kid, it did mean you were touching, but obviously it had the, yeah. Apparently Hitchcock liked the bit in Psycho where somebody talks about Norman stuffing birds, because obviously that has a double meaning in Britain. So I'm not sure if it wasn't that kind of, I don't know what Rebecca thinks about that.
Yeah, obviously it's got that sort of stronger sexual suggestion to it. But I think here it kind of means, you know, pawing at her, just sort of like touching her when she doesn't want to be touched, sort of like mauling her.
All right, that makes a lot more sense because, yeah, I just had the one meaning in mind. I was like, you can't be saying that because you would be filing for assault, you know, even in 1972 at this point. So I was curious what you guys thought about the presence of Anna Massey, because, of course, when I see her, the first thing I think of is Peeping Tom. But again, she had credits way beyond that. But that's the thing I'm most familiar with her. And I wasn't sure how Hitchcock thought of Peeping Tom, because Peeping Tom, basically, Powell came in and ate a lot of Hitchcock's lunch that year.
Yeah, well, Peeping Tom kind of forecasts Frenzy. And I spoke about this last year at an event where we looked at The Birth of the Slasher with Peeping Tom and Psycho. And obviously we've got the streets of London, the griminess, the serial killer. This is a time for sleaziness, seediness in general in cinema. As Ian's already said, Straw Dogs, but things like Clockwork Orange, Witchfinder General. But Anna Massey as Babs, she's street smart. She gives as good as she gets. She is really engaging and interesting and memorable. She reads Blaney pretty well, I think. She questions him later about some of his actions, and she's right to do that. But she also believes and trusts that he's innocent as well, and she's right to do that as well. She has the measure of foresight as well, I think, which is quite correct. But unfortunately, she just slightly misreads Rusk, which we'll talk about later, I'm sure.
Yeah, she apparently auditioned for the role of the Monica Barlick secretary. That was a really smart decision on his part, because I know that Helen Mirren was talked about for the Babs part, but Anna Massey is perfect. I mean, apart from, as we were saying before, it's slightly unconvincing because she is such a smart character that she put up with this ghastly Blaney. But she's really appealing, but also she does seem to come from that world, very much so. And it's also because social class is quite an element in the film, and she really works on that level as well. It's also really awful. I mean, I'm not sure, it's going to say it's really awful when she's murdered, but I think that that's obviously partly why she's playing the role, is that we do relate to, we do sympathise with it. So it's all the more unpleasant when her fate is all the more distressing to us. Yeah.
And she almost solves, quote unquote, the murderer when she's a corpse, you know, by her grabbing onto the tie pin, which I know we'll talk about, but she pretty much becomes like the clue. She becomes the tie pin almost, because she's so inexorably linked with it. So you have to break her freaking fingers to get it out. Ugh, which is, that's something. But yeah, this is around the time too where we're introduced to the Robert Rusk character, played by Barry Foster. And he just brings such mirth to this role. I really, you know, for as much as bad as John Finch's character is, this guy, Barry Foster, is just playing such a likable person. He just seems like, you know, the whole thing of like, well, Bob's your uncle. He just seems so caring and giving Blamey a tip for a horse that's going to come in at 20-1. And then the horse does come in. It's like, wow, this guy is just terrific. How nice of this person. And then also that he is a small businessman and he seems to be doing pretty well for himself.
He seems really obviously to be based on Neville Heath. It was a murderer that Hitchcock was fascinated by. And it's weird because Michael Caine turned down the Rusk part. Michael Caine also looks like Neville Heath. But Heath was apparently very charming and also very witty. And there's a great story of when he was going to be hanged, it was traditional to give a whiskey to the condemned man. He said, under the circumstances, could you make that a double? He was always, he was this kind of gentleman. I mean, I was going to say he was a gentleman sex murderer, but then, and that's a contradiction, but then so is Bob Brooks. You know, it's this, the likable person who does, you know, terrible things. Hitchcock seems to have had Heath in mind, the Rusk car.
As Truffaut, I think, pointed out, Hitchcock reveals the identity of the killer 15 minutes into the film. And in the gallery of Hitchcock villains, I think he's very familiar because he, what I call charms to deceive, and we're drawn into him so much more, like Brandon and Rope and Bruno and Strangers and Uncle Charlie. How well turned out he is as well, his presentation, and how Hitchcock corrupts that idea of who we might trust. And one of you mentioned before about this idea of the likable villain, the unlikable wrong man. And I just wanted to talk about like doubling in the film and how Blaney is, you know, disrespectful, he drinks, he gambles. And by contrast, Rusk's this polite, controlled mother's boy. And one's obviously blonde and one's dark. And we've got that double in two in the two murders we see, Mirror and Psycho. And something I'm interested in that I need to maybe flesh out a bit more, but is an idea of another doubling, which is like the notion of private versus public violence. So, you know, we see Blaney, a lot of his violence is public, the crushing of the grapes at the club, at the hospital, whereas Rusk's violence is very much behind closed doors. And there's that moment as well where Rusk says, brothers-in-law, which kind of binds them. And it's this idea of law as well within the film as well, like being lawless and the effectiveness of the law as well. And I think, yeah, we've spoken about Blaney's character, but there's no charm with Blaney, and there's no sense of a journey with him either. For me, it's Hitchcock's wrong men. I think by the end of a film, you get a sense that they've learnt something. There's been an arc there somewhere. For me, I think there's this kind of sense of entitlement with Blaney, this idea that the world is against me a little, you know?
He also treats women like shit. I mean, that's what's significant, that what we see of Rusk when he's killing people, he's actually, you know, he's nice, he's warm, he's helpful. And what you see Blaney all the time, he seems to make a point treating women like shit. I mean, he's so cruel to his ex-wife. And so self-pity. And I think it's notable, he's not just horrible, he seems specifically to have a real issue with women. You referred to him in the book as the wrongest of Hitchcock's wrong men, because I can't find another one who's quite so unpleasant. And obviously Rusk is contrasted with that, you know. I'm not sure how well that plays now. You know, it's like watching it with younger people. People often find Rusk a bit creepy now in that kind of sleazy 70s kind of way. And I don't think that would have been the case at the time. One for the Birds now sounds all kind of pretty icky. But I don't think it did then, yeah.
His business is selling fruit and vegetables, it looks like, in Covent Garden. Is that right? And what is the significance of Covent Garden? Because I don't think I've ever been there when I've been to England.
The fruit and veg market isn't there anymore. It moved. And Hitchcock kind of captured it 2 years before it moved. I mean, aside from this all the talk about the Garden of Eden and the Garden of Love and this and that, and there's obviously a whole thing about food and appetite. But also Hitchcock's dad, of course, was a greengrocer. And he used to sell stuff at Covent Garden. So I think there is a sort of personal aspect. When you go there now, it's just this kind of thing full of tourists. It's not, but you can't, I mean, it's weird when you go there, you walk past Henrietta Street, which is where Rusk, you know, that's still there, is Rusk's house. I think it's a personal, you know, the film is shot through with all these autobiographical things for Hitchcock. And I think that the Covent Garden, the greengrocer setting is a big part of that.
This idea of Rusk's profession just ties in with him being sweet and sour, maybe, and this idea of forbidden. So, yeah, it's... And again, yeah, Covent Garden, it's just... It's a, a return to Hitchcock. And you, Hitchcock, actually, now I'm thinking of it, there's a few films with Markets in, like, The Man Who Knew Too Much, I think, the 56 one, there's Markets there, To Catch a Thief, I think, as well. So I think it's like this idea of the public, you know, Hitchcock's very interested in how things affect the public and has been in public spaces and obviously juxtaposing those with private spaces as well.
It almost feels like, other than the potato truck that takes us out of the city, it feels like this whole movie takes place within a few, I don't know if it's a few miles or a few blocks, but everything feels very walkable, where our characters are walking quite a bit in this film, even when we eventually meet the characters of John and Hetty. They seem to be a walkable distance away, to the point where they're meeting John and Babs and Blaney, you've got Hetty looking at them from their apartment just a little ways away, looking down at them. So it just all feels like there's a very small world that we're dealing with in just a few blocks of space, and we've got characters walking into buildings, walking out of buildings, and that will become a big clue slash red herring later on as far as Blaney walking into a building and then coming out and being seen coming out after Rusk has already gotten there, and him not knowing what the hell's going on, as typical for a Hitchcock protagonist we have. Yeah, I was reminded a lot of Bruno and Guy, but it was almost a Bruno and Guy where Bruno didn't tell Guy, I'm going to do this for you, or like, I'm going to use what I do to put the blame on you. It felt like a twist. Even though Guy and Bruno are a twisted relationship already, it felt even more twisted. Like, it felt at first like, I'm going to take care of your problems. Well, actually, I am your problem, and I'm going to put you away for the crimes that I'm committing.
What is weird, though, as well, with the... because Christie's mentioned at one point. The Christie, which people, you know, if you're not familiar with it, know from 10 Rillington Place. And what is weird, obviously, there's quite a lot of it. Christie turns up a lot in the film, sort of in spirit, as well as being name-checked. But of course, there was a wrong man in the Christie case. You know, that man was hanged for Christie's crimes. So there is actually, it's funny, I thought a lot about the real-life murders that influenced the film, and it hadn't struck me until quite recently that, you know, the Christie, it took place in London, the Christie murders, but also, you know, there was a wrong man, and he did, it's not known how much Christie set up Timothy Evans, but then you have the Rusk character doing the same. You know, he actually ends up setting up. So you do have, yeah, I mean, I think you're right. It's this, I was going to say an even more maligned Bruno. Bruno's pretty maligned anyway.
Yeah, the mention of Christie is from these two guys at a bar that are just like, oh, hey, yeah, this is great. Having these murders in town, this is really putting us on the map again, and we'll get all kinds of tourists from it. And I'm like, these are the most cynical SOBs I've ever heard.
Well, Oliver Stone did that, though. When he was in, there was a series of murders a few years ago of sex workers, and Oliver Stone came up to present an award at the BAFTAs and said, oh, it's so great to be back in England. There's fog and there's ripped whores. You know, it's not 1972 anymore. You can't say that kind of thing. It's weird when you teach the film, or when you show it to students, the dialogue is often more shocking than a lot of the incidents. You know, the sort of casual misogyny in the way people speak, you know.
Yeah, I like how that mention of Christie creates a bridge. I see that as Hitchcock just creating this bridge between the cinematic world and the real world, which I'm sure would be very hard-hitting. And those two men in the pub who are like these sort of Shakespearean commentators, they make mention of social misfits, and it makes me think about how Bob fits into society so well and Blaney doesn't. He is that misfit. And to speak to like the notion of tourism, you know, Tanya Modleski writes about the contempt for tourism, or what we might equate with cinema as being tourism as well. It's just coming back to that idea of us as tourists coming to the cinema and thinking, oh, this is Hitchcock, this is what we can expect, and finding out that it's something very different.
Yeah, and we find out soon that the horse that was being talked about won by a mile, and that's also around the time that Bob's walking down the street and Dickie's up in the window and he's just like, have you met my mom? And he, like, this woman just pops her head out. I just, something about that is so funny to me. And then every time we go back to his apartment, I keep thinking, well, where's his mom? Isn't his mom there? Like, does she live with him or did she just stop by? I guess she just stopped by, but it was like, you know, look at what a lad I am.
The photograph is, we later see it on the mantelpiece, and I love that idea of, again, the facade of the respectable. You know, it's this notion of, I've got my mother's picture on the mantelpiece. How could I be a serial killer?
And yeah, you mentioned the food and the grapes, the way that Dickie gives Bob these grapes and everything, and it's just like, oh, okay, or did I say that right? The names. That Bob gives Dickie these grapes, and then when he gets upset, he just throws them down on the ground and crushes them. But yeah, we've got food through this whole movie. I mean, of course, having our criminal, you know, work in this food market, but also, you know, we'll talk about the cop and his wife later on. Oh my God, that whole relationship is all about food, and it's just wild. Those scenes are probably some of my favorite ones, but yeah, just that. He couldn't take that hint, couldn't go out and make that bet. I don't know if it was that he didn't have enough money, didn't have enough time, but he definitely didn't take that bet that a little birdie, again, I'm not sure if that's a real, obviously it's not a real bird, but I don't know what his source is or if it was another reference to a woman, because I know that y'all call women birds over there quite a bit. And so you wonder, what was his source? How does he know that of all the horses in this movie, this one who hasn't won is going to come in first place by a mile, he says.
And just on the back of that, I wanted to mention about this motif that I've identified with regards to, like, luck and fortune in the film. We repeatedly hear characters make mention of, you know, Rusk tells Blaney he can make a fortune on placing this bet. Blaney will later remark of how he's had filthy luck. You know, Babs will say, oh, that was lucky. And then there's things like lucky to be alive. Some people have all the luck. It really made me think about, is this coincidence and happenstance? And the more I thought about it, and particularly about Blaney and this sense of entitlement, I wondered about invitations around him using the idea of luck and fortune as excuses, really, and aiming this aggression and tension at Brenda. Because here's someone who's his ex-wife. Here's someone who's created something herself, you know, crucially in their separation. So without him, and she succeeded at it, whereas he is struggling. And I think he's really someone who, when there's nothing else to grasp onto, he's unwilling to take accountability. So he turns to luck and blames luck and fortune.
There's also this sense of fate in a lot of Hitchcock. You know, there's in when obviously it's Marion driving and she comes to the turn off. One road leads to California, the other leads to the base motel. And there seems to be quite a lot of that, you know, that fate itself plays a hand and something kind of malign about it. That, you know, things can go wrong and, you know, it's disaster is so near death and disaster. I think a lot of the time things that are really contrived in this film and in other Hitchcock films, the whole sort of wrong man aspect is often so contrived in the bad luck and the terrible fates that befall people. But it's almost like this is all of a piece, you know, that life is out to, what's the line from Detour, whichever way you turn, life will trip you up.
Like, I just happened to be at the United Nations and this guy gets stabbed across the room, but I go to help him and I pull out the knife. And that's just when the photographer comes and takes a picture of all the dumb luck. Come on. You mentioned Brenda Bailey and yeah, that we're introduced to her here and we're not really aware, at least I'm not aware when I'm watching this, that Richard has been married and we get to meet her and then we get to hear a little bit of the backstory and we get more of the backstory of their marriage throughout this film, eventually finding out that they wanted a quick divorce. So they agreed that he would put down or she would put down in the reasonings that he was just really abusive to her. So he was able to get that quick divorce. And then, yeah, Brenda, like you said, she has built something out of nothing. She's built this whole dating service, friendship service that she has. And we're introduced to these two characters, this very small man and taller woman. And it just feels, I mean, this whole thing just feels so Hitchcockian for me as far as like the way that, you know, like, oh, well, we're just mad about beekeeping and like, let's go back to my place. And the way that she's brushing his shoulder, like, oh, you need something for your dandruff. And I wrote in my notes, you know, this guy's just doomed. He's going to be henpecked for the rest of his life. And I think he's there for it. I think this is what he's been looking for this whole time, is somebody to be that henpecker and to just, you know, put him in his place, it feels.
Doomed is the same word that I've got. Yeah. And I wanted to talk about this Blaney agency of love and marriage and how it becomes a site of both love, sex, death, all taking place and converging in that same location, and how really relationships in this film as a whole, romantic relationships, that is, are presented in a very doomed way. I mean, marriage is full of conflict. Look at Hetty and Johnny. I mean, I can't see their time in Paris being filled with romance. Divorce makes people unhappy. You know, Brenda and Blaney, I mean, arguably Brenda's happy, but certainly not Blaney. Trying to start a new relationship's also blighted. Babs and Blaney, you know, their relationship doesn't come to a good end. And even this couple at the marriage bureau, it's an actual bleak portrayal of love and understanding between the sexes. You know, when they're leaving and she says, you know, oh, my husband would clean from like 5 a.m. till 9 a.m. every day. This is this guy's future and it's not looking good.
Yeah, I think that it's like you say, I mean, the fundamental incompatibility of men and women seems to go through this whole thing. And the only relationship that seems even quite nice is the Oxfords, and we give it to assume that's a celibate relationship. So it is this idea, really, it's very, very dark view. It reminded me of what Simon Shepherd said, was the war between men and women. It's interesting that isn't there in the novel, that the Hetty and Johnny character seem, they're quite warm. They stick with Blaney all the way through. So it's a deliberate strategy. And that, yeah, that obviously isn't there in the novel, that the bit with the Australian woman and the little man. Yeah, it just seems to be this unbelievably pessimistic. Even without the murders, you've got such a bleak view of sexual relationships. It's so grim, yeah. And I mean, I guess at a push, then Rusk and his crimes are just an extension of this. You've got all this misogyny, this casual kind of misogyny. You've got the equation of women's dead bodies with waste in the beginning. And in that kind of world where you can't have a healthy relationship, I guess Rusk is the end product of that.
Yeah, and this idea as well of like love being manufactured and you know, the idea of making money out of love as well. You know, Blaney says, if you can't make love, sell it. And it's that idea for me of love as a business, as something transactional, and how if that's the backdrop to this world, well, of course, all we're going to get is love that's very inharmonious.
This is also where we get introduced to her secretary, Monica, played by Jean Marsh. And Monica, it's an interesting role, especially later on when she's asked to give a description of the man that she saw, and she gives this amazing police description of Richard.
Miss Barling, could you describe Mr. Blaney for us? What he looked like, what he was wearing, and so on?
Well, yes, I think I can. He was a man in his 30s, about an inch or so under 6 foot tall. He had dark hair, green eyes, and a moustache. I estimate his weight at about 155 pounds. He was wearing a rather old-fashioned jacket with leather patches on the shoulders and at the elbows. In my opinion, it was quite unsuitable for London. He was also carrying a raincoat.
That's an extraordinarily precise description, Miss Barling.
In my job, I've learned to keep a sharp eye on men, Inspector.
Also, we have this whole thing of what she hears versus what she sees, and we'll definitely be talking about audio as we go through this, especially later on in the court sequence. But that, the court, as well as the courtyard, the moment I was talking about earlier with Johnny and Hetty, and you get their dialogue is silent for her, and it's silent for us as the viewers. It so reminds me of, going back to North by Northwest, the whole scene on the tarmac with the noise of the planes, where you've got Leo G. Carroll explaining things to Cary Grant and vice versa, and everything is completely blocked out by the sound of aircraft. So it's like he's able to catch up on the story, though we don't have to hear it all again because we've already seen it. We don't need to know all of this stuff. As opposed to in this movie where you have the inspector, Oxford, and his wife, and he explains the entire movie to her, at least as far as his perspective goes. And I'm just like, okay, I haven't seen this before. Normally, Hitchcock would just blank this out, but it's almost like for the people in the back, this is what's going on, just in case you weren't aware of what's happening. But I am jumping ahead a little bit because we do have the whole thing, like I said, at the restaurant where it is Brenda and Richard having this lunch and she sneaks some money to him. He doesn't understand that, doesn't know about it until later on when he's almost pickpocketed at a Salvation Army place. And that great shot of him walking out of the restaurant and walking almost right into the camera and the way we go out of focus as a transition to the next scene. That was interesting because there's no chance shots in Hitchcock film, right? So I'm just like, okay, that was a choice. I'm not sure why you did that, but that was an interesting choice to do that.
You had the difficult relationship with Finch, and it does look like that wasn't blocked, but it does look quite effective, so you kept it here. Because it's funny, there's a similar shot in Cape Fear, which is obviously deliberate, where De Niro nearly walks into the camp. So I wasn't sure if that, you know, didn't inspire that. Just one thing about the secretary, the Monica Barling character. We've talked before about how everybody's kind of a bit dowdy in the film. It's a really ugly view of London. And I think it's weird that she's so beautiful, Jean Marsh. And it's like, on some level, obviously Hitchcock wanted to, well, not ugly her up, but, you know, make her kind of more dowdy. So she becomes this parody of the busybody secretary with these enormous glasses. And her character is just bizarre. And her performance is fantastic. It really... every time I want to feel more of her character, I have a theory that he's trying to ugly people up anyway. I mean, Finch, who's a good-looking guy, look with that ridiculous jacket, that sort of that patched jacket that he wears. She's obviously fulfills an important task in the film, but I mean, she's fantastic. I just want more of her in the film every time she's on screen.
Oh yeah, the whole use of the glasses for the busybody women. I mean, Patricia Hitchcock in Strangers on a Train with those incredibly thick glasses that she has.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk to the idea of female threat as well before we move on. And I mean, I've already spoken about, you know, Brenda being successful, you know, but she's also warm, she's open, she's got qualities, accomplishments that I think Blaney really envies and resents. And it's her that sits behind the desk of power in the office. That's a really strong image, actually. And he is the invited visitor. She has a club. Normally in the, you know, films, you know, this time it would be the men's club. She's got the club. She takes care of the dinner. She takes care of the tip and the taxi. So she is the provider. She is financially independent. And in being self-sufficient, she really reminds me of Lisa Fremont in Rear Window and the threat that she represents to Jeff there. I think as well, you know, we mentioned Oxford's wife. The treatment of women in this film and, you know, I guess where these women all end up, to me, it puts a question mark over whether the film's seeking to punish women who are confident and liberated and independent, while it's the stay-at-home wife of Oxford who survives. So for me, that's the big question mark. Or is it commentating really on the behaviour of men? I think it's both. But
I think it is weird when you see it as part of a wave of films made around that time. It's really hard to not think there is something going on with these great films in response to feminism generally. Because, I mean, when you had the collapse of the production code and a lot of new freedoms and the freedom to put nudity and sex on screen, so many directors just straight away thought, right, now we can film rape scenes, not sex scenes. And, you know, Clockwork Orange, Straw Dogs. I don't think it's as simple as Hitchcock thinking, I don't think independent women are a good thing. But there is clearly something in the zeitgeist, you know, this fascination with kind of gangsters and mobsters and super macho men and, you know, women being treated like shit. When you watch a lot of movies from that period, and I mean, you know, I think 1971 was maybe the best year. In my experience, it's the best year for films has ever been. But my God, you know, women get a pretty grim, a grim time in a lot of those films. And Frenzy, you know, taken it, I don't think you can separate it from those other again, equally good films, but they're really quite, you know, difficult.
The scene when Robert comes to visit Brenda, so we finally get his return to the film, and this is when we get the whole revelation that he's actually the necktie killer. This scene goes on for a long time and is kind of excruciating in the way that it should be, because the way that she tries to bargain with him and constantly is like, no, let's go back to my place. Let's go over here. You know, oh, that might be my secretary coming back. Oh, I need to pick up the phone because somebody might come around and interrupt us. And just she's trying to placate him at the same time, also trying to escape and avoid her fate. And it just keeps closing in and closing in and closing in. And it's just, oh, it's a really excruciating scene. This murder, we've seen people being played with, but generally I'm trying to think of in Hitchcock films, have we seen a scene like this where you know somebody's going to die and it's not quicker than this, because it just goes on for a while. And plus, like we said, there's the rape, because it's the rape and then the murder. Though it doesn't sound like it was always that way when it came to the real case. It sounds like it was more the murder and then possibly the rape.
Yeah, it's funny because I was reading before this, because I'm not sure in the book. I mean, I don't know what Rebecca thinks, but it seems like the rape, it's an attempted rape and a murder. And it's, I think it's deliberately kind of befuddled. But I found this quote from Hitchcock talking about Christie, where he said he was a man inspired by his impotence to murder 8 women. And it, you know, this idea that, you know, and Oxford says that later on, don't mistake rape for potency. And so you have this sense of, you know, women, you know, you're all the same and all this. But I think it's deliberately sort of fudged as to what actually happens, whether that's for reasons of, so weird to say, decorum in a scene so awful. But what I think is notable as well is the cross and the her praying, and, you know, the idea that that's just not going to do any good. You know, it's like the whole, Rebecca mentioned nihilism. It's this idea that, you know, nothing you do will help you, and, you know, nobody will come to rescue you, not even, you know, God. So it's a very bleak affair.
This to me seems like a replay of a scene with Blaney, which is interesting. And although there's the similarities, like the sense of entitlement, the aggression and their behaviours, there's also a difference as well. Rusk violates right from the beginning in his behaviours. He comes in uninvited. He also violates through going through the filing cabinets as well. Like, that is a violation of privacy of women. And, you know, in terms of the details, the personal information, what happens to Brenda is horrific. But the way we see her think through Rusk's build to the attack, everything that you just mentioned there, Mike, the boundaries she tries to set, I think she does a really good job of trying to keep things on track and just trying every possible way that she can. You know, she's proven to be quite smart, resourceful. She's very alert. But to use your word, Mike, she just cannot bargain with him. And I think he makes this comment about, you know, but I like you. And I think he likes her because she is a conquest. She's a struggle. And I think the moment of her giving into that struggle is a really complex one. And I wonder, is this an act of defiance in some way? Because she knows it's the struggle that turns him on. It is a very protracted scene and it is inevitable where it's going. And I don't read this as it's not a climax for Rusk. You know, he grows really angry and it reminds me of Rope, actually, where it's that point of strangulation that seems to be the orgasmic moment. But what's really macabre is the way that she's left. It's so undignified and it makes such a mockery out of the image as well, like with her tongue hanging out. It's this really twisted, macabre, comedic sourness to it. You just don't know where to put your emotions with this image. It puts you in conflict, I think. And I liked your point that you made, Ian, and I read your book and you made a wonderful point about the violation of Rusk putting his hand into her purse and that being like an echo of what's happened to her. And that made me think of Tony Wenderson in Dialing for Murder, and how he goes not just into a purse, but into a bag that's within a purse, and how that's another example of that. And to put this rape in an environment that's supposed to represent friendship, love, marriage. And again, later we'll go to the Cupid room, and that'll become a place of hostility as well that people need to escape from. It leaves such a nasty taste. It really does.
Well, and I forgot about the praying part, because I love the reading of Shadow of a Doubt as Uncle Charlie as vampire, and this whole idea of, you know, praying to keep away the devil, the demon, has no effect at all. And then, yeah, his whole almost shamanistic repetition of lovely, lovely, lovely. And at first I'm like, is this marking him thrusting? Like when he says lovely, is this what's happening? And you cut back to him and he's between her legs, but not in the right position, let's say. So I'm just like, okay, is he masturbating? What's going on with this? But it was just a very odd way of shooting this, but also at the same time, the right way of doing it, because it is so confusing. You're just like, I don't know exactly how this is happening, but yeah, you're right. The way that it culminates, it is definitely the choking, the murder itself that is the climax moment for him.
All the ways these women are left in the film, it's very undignified always. It's the way the face is positioned, whether it's the eyes, the tongue. It's very nasty and it's very dehumanizing.
When you've got him afterwards going through her lunch and taking her lunch, taking that apple. So again, kind of this snake in Eden type of imagery that we have, and the way that he was picking on her for not having a very proper lunch, I thought was interesting. Again, going back to the whole food theme of this movie. And then you've got the him leaving, going out, and then you've got Monica coming back in, you know, eventually, sorry, I should say that Blamey comes in, goes up, can't get into the office. So then he leaves, and that's when Monica sees him leaving. She goes up into the office, and you wait for a long time before she finally screams. You know that scream is coming, but it just takes a lot longer than you think it would. And then I think it was Ian, in your book, where you pointed out that the people passing by, the two women passing by, they just kind of like look up and then keep on walking. There's no like, oh, we have to go help this person. It is very much like, no, this happens.
You know, what we were talking about, this notion of this is just a world where love is doomed to fail and terrible things happen to people unless those people are women. I mean, the fact that it's women as well is significant. So we would read it different if it was two men. We just walk on. Yeah, they just pause for a minute and then it's like, well, nothing to see here.
Richard gets back with Babs. They have this whole thing of, you know, getting my things. And that's when we meet. I kind of miss the connection between he and Babs, Richard and Babs hanging out, and then going to Johnny, because the Johnny character for me just kind of showed up and I must have missed the dialogue to explain his presence. But Clive Swift as Johnny, I think is fantastic. And I've always enjoyed Billy Whitelaw. Mostly I know her from her performance in Hot Fuzz, but she's terrific in this. And just, again, so shrewish. She's just like the person who doesn't believe anything. And not only does he have the cops after him now, but now he's got Hetty, who just keeps undermining him. And every time he brings up she just keeps painting him into a corner. She basically is the witness for the prosecution in this.
Yeah, there's that whole thing with the Air Force and, you know, Johnny. I don't think that works, all the Suez thing. In the novel, it's World War II, and the Blaney character took part in the firebombing of Dresden. So you do have this sense that he's already haunted by the terrible things he's done. When he's arrested for the murders, he says he killed thousands in Dresden. And obviously, Hitchcock wanted a younger actor, but the idea that, oh, well, we've got to have some combat veteran, let's make it Suez. I don't think that works. When I first saw the film, I couldn't believe that Finch and Clive Swift were around the same age, although I looked it up and they are. They're not that. They look, you know, quite different in age.
It looks like he could be his father. Yeah.
So I thought, oh, this is really unconvincing. And I looked it up and there's like 6 years between them or something. I mean, I said this before in the novel, they're really nice. I mean, there's a bit when Blaney's away at trial where Hetty brings him lobster and champagne. So it's a deliberate decision to make her so unpleasant and so judgmental, and it fits in with the whole world of the film. And also, they mentioned going to Paris. In the film, he does go to Paris. Blaney goes to Paris and then comes back. The screenplay is so much better than the novel in almost every way. You really see how Chaffer did such a good job on what is basically a bit of pulp. So all these things that slowed the narrative down, like trips to Paris and that really lengthy trial scene, they've all got to the strength of the film.
To spend as much time as we do with the potato truck, that's where this movie shines. Trips to Paris, I don't think so. And we get I kind of skipped over this whole thing at the hotel. Like, eventually Richard does find out that he was secreted this money by his wife, his ex-wife. And I was like, okay, great. He can, I don't know, rent a room or do this or do that. But instead, he goes and gets Babs. And then it's like, hey, let's go to a love motel and have some sex. And I'll get my suit pressed and everything. Again, reminding me a lot of North by Northwest with this whole thing with the suit and all that. What's a man going to do for 20 minutes without his pants, right? That whole thing. Or 2 hours, I think it is. I wasn't giving Cary Grant enough credit there.
End of credit, yeah.
That's really his undoing, is this whole thing of, you know, giving that jacket and, like I said, the way that the secretary describes everything about him so clearly, and especially talking about that jacket with the patches on the arms. And they're talking about it like, he must be pretty poor to have patches on his arms. It's like they're not familiar with that whole fashion style. Like, this is every professor that I've ever had has jackets with patches on the arms. But I was curious, you mentioned in the notes, Ian, that there was a scene that was cut here as far as the clothes.
You see stills from it sometimes that there was an instance of a woman runs out of Rusk's apartment, sort of semi-naked, just carrying a blouse. Rusk comes after her, passing copper stops, says, "What's going on?" And Rusk says, "Oh, the bloody little fool. She ran off the minute I started taking off my tie." And the copper says, "Oh, you really need to start wearing turtlenecks." And there's this kind of laugh. And it works in terms of, you know, ha-ha, you know, blokes together having a laugh when we know he really is this murderer. But I think maybe the reason it went is then if he'd have killed somebody or even attacked somebody while Blaney was in the hotel, Blaney would have an alibi. But I don't know. I can't find out. Margaret Nolan was the actress that turns up in quite a lot of things in the early 70s. I'm not quite sure why it went, except maybe for time reasons, because it is quite a long film anyway. But yeah, that scene would have gone there before they wake up in the Coburg Hotel.
Yeah, I'd love when he eventually does meet up with Johnny and Hetty starts asking, "Oh, how's Brenda?" And I was like, "Oh, well, that's right. They were divorced on the grounds of extreme cruelty. That's what it was." Yeah, then she just is like, "Oh, yeah, no, I read the paper, you idiot."
They're hinting at something there, because when she says what you made her do, and it used to be, I don't know when this stopped, but it used to be that sodomy or anal sex was grounds for divorce in Britain. You know, that you could always say, well, he performed this degrading act. And it seems like they're stepping around that quite a lot. They're suggesting it's this kind of depraved sexual practices. And given that that was one that could, you know, was considered to be, you know, mentally and physically cruel, I'm not sure if that's not what they're getting at, you know. And again, it feeds into this idea of the bestial lusts of men that women are subject to.
This is around the time that we're introduced to the police, and we've got, I mentioned, Inspector Oxford and his wife. We'll meet his wife pretty soon. Also introduced to Sergeant Spearman, and Rebecca, I think you mentioned Clockwork Orange earlier, and I mostly know this guy as the prison guard at the prison that Alex is in. And that was just the year before, which is kind of wild because he looks younger in this movie than he did in the previous one. They must have put some gray in his hair for that film, but he's fantastic. I always love when he shows up in things. And then this whole thing of seeing Inspector Oxford eating this English breakfast and talking about how, you know, you should have these three times a day type of thing, because he is not getting proper breakfast at home. When we finally get to meet his wife and that she is taking all of these French cooking classes, and I'm trying to remember when, I think this is right before Julia Child kind of took over the airwaves here in the U.S. with the French chef, right? But yeah, these dishes that she serves him are just ridiculous. The most ridiculous things I've ever seen, like that she serves him quail that is about 4 inches long. It's like they're smaller than the chickens in Eraserhead. You know, they're just these tiny things. They're in danger of being crushed by the grapes that are next to them.
And that fish soup is revolting. Yeah.
Pilchards.
And when she lists off all the fish that were in there, they're the most disgusting sounding fish that there are.
Frogfish, yeah.
But she becomes his counsel. She is the one, you know, he's there telling all these tales about this case, and she seems to be the one that is figuring things out way before he is.
I've got a note about them being kind of stand-ins maybe for Hitchcock and Alma, because she has that role. And There's a comment about woman's intuition, which we also get in Rear Window. Sorry to keep bringing Rear Window up. But it's this idea of, why can't women just be smart and intelligent? Why is it going to be like women's intuition? Which, yeah, she's always pointing out where he's going wrong. And she makes that comment, doesn't she, about them being together in 8 years and he can't keep his eyes open. It's clear, really, that she's substituting food and sex for one another, and she really wants to just spice things up a little bit. And I guess it's this idea that on the surface, these romantic dinners and end of the day conversations might look ideal, but actually they're both on slightly different tracks.
No, she's not in the novel. In the novel, Oxford is a character, he's a minor character, but there's nothing of the Oxford's out. So again, this is something that, you know, it really works. It's a great, great part of the film. But also, that's complete invention from Schaffer and Hitchcock. And I think Rebecca's right. I think it's a portrait of Alma and Hitch, really. And although the food is ghastly and all this, they do actually seem quite warm together. And it's the only hope for some kind of warmth in the whole film.
Though they look at her like she's got three heads when she serves a margarita, which is so funny to me. I mean, the difference between 1972 and 2024 is like, margarita, yeah. Everybody knows what a margarita is. But when it comes to this in 1972, it's like, what the hell are you talking? Tequila? Triple sec? What are you talking about? And then, like, even when she talks about putting salt around the rim of the glass, it's like, oh boy, how weird is this?
And she pronounced tequila. And I always think the beer. And it's like, did people pronounce it that way then, or is it just some kind of weird foreign word? That always, I mean, I never know why, I don't, you know, that, I really noticed that, because it's like, you know, I don't know, maybe people didn't, maybe it was so unusual then. I mean, it was a very different time.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, remember how people treated sushi in the 1980s in movies? It was just like, oh, it's raw fish. Yeah, this is around the time that we get back to Felix Forsythe, played by Bernard Cribbins, who most people know as the crying man in the tuxedo gif from Doctor Who, I believe is how he's famous now. But he is turning in his former employee and eventually puts Robert and Babs together. And then the murder of Babs all takes place off screen, but it is such a wonderful way that they do this. You know, it's kind of a nice thing that they are returning to this camera outside of the house or the business that we had earlier that we just talked about with the scream from the inside and you're waiting for the scream. This one is so similar, but the camera follows them and follows them up into Richard's apartment or up the stairs to his apartment and takes us pretty much right to the door, if memory serves. And then the door closes and we go back out the same way that we came in. And Ian, I will tell you, I never noticed that cut. You mentioned there's a hidden cut in this that we go from a soundstage to a location. Never saw that before. It is so clean the way that we go right outside with that. It's so nice.
Yeah, it works really well. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense when you see those houses in Henrietta Street that it would be, they're really cramped inside. They obviously, it's a set, the staircase is a set, but yeah, the cheek cut is really well done there.
And that's what sets us up with the whole potato truck thing, that he's trying to get rid of the body. And that's the whole problem through so much of this is once you murder somebody, what do you do with the body? And the way that he doesn't dispose of the body of Brenda is what, you know, sinks Finch's character. But with this, he's like, okay, we're going to take the body away, put it in this potato truck, put it in a sack, you know, just completely, you know, you talked about the sacredness of a corpse, and there is no sacredness here, the way that he just dumps her in there. And when he goes back and realizes that he doesn't have his tie pin, it's funny, I just rewatched Blood Simple 2 days ago, and it was so similar to the moment of M. Emmett Walsh when he realizes that he doesn't have his lighter with his name on it. And here we have the tie pin with the R on it, which is funny because that R tie pin, that could belong to Richard or to Robert, but definitely belongs to one of them. And the way that we have that, I mean, that scene, the potato truck scene goes on for so long, but it is so masterfully crafted to have us wrong-footed a few times, to, you know, oh, we're all set with this now. No, we're not. And the way that he keeps ratcheting things up. Oh, there's potatoes falling onto the road. Is he going to get caught this way? Oh, he's stopping at this truck stop. Is he going to get caught this way? This is like the masterclass for me, is this whole sequence with the potato truck.
With putting the position of sympathizing with him, it's like, oh my God, this is his nightmare scenario. And it's, I think I said this in the book, there's a bit in which Hitchcock talked about in Psycho where Norman dumps the car and there's a moment where it looks like it's not going to sink. And Hitchcock, you know, the people thought, oh no, you know, oh. And so you're forced into kind of empathizing with this person who's hiding the body. And it's weird because it is grotesque and it's funny and it is really quite distressing. But also it's like, there's a part of me that's thinking, this is, you know, this, how much worse can it get? He sneezes and then the potatoes fall out. And it is a really, really bizarre scene because it makes us feel so many different things. And it's so well done. It's like he doesn't want to try and top the murder, so we don't see the murder about. You know, it's a model of restraint. And then he gives us this really grotesque situation with the potato truck, yeah.
Yeah, I love these moments when something goes wrong for a Hitchcock villain, which invariably it does. You know, when they think they've executed the perfect murder, like Tony again in Dialing for Murder with his watch not being worn correctly. And here it's the pin, interestingly too. In both cases, yeah, I agree with you, Ian. We are in a space of like conflict of empathy, and both men are in contained settings. That contained setting of him being in the van really adds to the suspense and just that reflection of his psychological state of mind. I think as well, it's the combination of the humour, the empathy, but this idea of some kind of revenge being enacted upon Rusk as well from the female corpse. In it holding the pin as well and holding it so tight, it's threatening power. That's how I see it. It's power that's unfortunately come too late, but it's power that she manages to exercise over him, if only for a short time. And she can screw with him, but there's nothing that he can do now to hurt or harm her, but she can still screw with him. And I like that. And I think this is really the first sign where we see a slippage of Rusk's power. So the way that those are combined, I think, is nice.
I was surprised, though, that we do get to see a shot of Babs outside of the truck and outside of the bag that she's in. You mentioned the trailer earlier and the whole thing with Hitchcock with the leg in the potato sack and things. And here we kind of have that, but I was so surprised that they went and showed what her face looks like. I really thought that we were going to avoid that because it really, you know, you're talking about how she finally has a little bit of power, but that just humiliates her. Her humiliates a corpse, you know, and it's really tough to see that especially because we liked Bab so much.
It's really distressing. I mean, I'm not sure how we're supposed to take, we talked about that, Brenda with the tongue sticking out. There's always a part of me that thinks Hitchcock is trying, is partly degrade there. Also, I think it's supposed to be so funny, but it's just awful when we see Babs. You know, it's a really shocking moment. Yeah.
I don't know when Robert has decided that he's pinning all of this stuff onto Richard, because the way that he leaves the ex-wife, he doesn't know what has occurred when it comes to Robert coming in to see her and slapping the furniture so it sounds like he's hitting her and just all of these things. He doesn't know any of that stuff, but he leaves the corpse there, leaves his friend in the lurch, makes it look like he's the murderer, though again, it could have been anybody. And then now killing Babs, it's, you know, doesn't know where Richard's at, doesn't know if he's got an alibi or anything. But when they meet back up again, then it's like, oh my gosh, I will take care of you. Don't worry about this. Here, give me your bag. I'll walk this over to my place. You can stay there. And as he's walking with the bag, or probably more likely once he gets to his place and he has to get there fast and first, so he has Richard do this whole circuitous route to get to the place because he doesn't want him there right away, really. Then when the cops just suddenly show up and all of those clothes, Babs's clothes, were stuffed into that suitcase that Richard owned. So it's, open and shut case. And then you have the whole trial sequence, which again, I was glad, Ian, in your book, when you're talking about how they shorten that up, it sounds a lot smarter. And again, we've seen all of these things. We know all of the reasons. We've even gotten a lot of stuff from Hetty where she's like, oh, well, they're going to say this and they're going to say this. And, you know, like she is the, like I said, the witness for the prosecution. She's laying out all of the things that the cops are going to accuse him of. And then to shore that up so much and then also just give us little flavors of that when it comes to the audio and the way that the, I guess he's a bailiff or something outside the door, opens up the door and we hear what's going on in the trial. And then the door closes. We hear nothing again. And then we get just like little brief moments of the audio coming through the door and the way that it's framed, where we have Richard on one side and the prosecution on the other side. And then we get that great him like, no, no, it was Rusk. It was Rusk. And we get that exact same thing repeated again for Inspector Oxford to think about shortly thereafter and get that replay. And it's finally like, oh, maybe it was Rusk. Maybe I should look into this. It reminded me a little bit of the end of, speaking of Anthony Perkins, it reminded me a little bit of the end of Pretty Poison, when it's him being set up for all the murders that Tuesday Weld committed. And it's like, oh, well, maybe I should look into this, John Randolph says, and starts his investigation.
Yeah, I mean, the book does grind to a halt during the trial for the reasons you said. I mean, it's all been, you can kind of imagine how the trial's going to go anyway. And it goes on for ages and ages. Trial seems like cinematic, but they're not very literary. The suggestion that maybe Blaney will get off, and you read and you think, there's no way he's going to get off. You know, this is just, and the way it's done, it's so cinematic. Really, it's masterful. I really like that. You know, just the use of the silence and the bits that we hear really works.
Yeah, it really gives you all the information that you need to know. And basically, it could be a newspaper that lands on somebody's doorstop that says, you know, necktie murder convicted type of thing. But thank goodness we don't do that. And then we get to move from our protagonist to our new protagonist, who is Inspector Oxford, and the way that he is now having to solve this and getting counsel from his wife over the pig's feet. Those horrible, horrible pig's feet. And her talking about what was in the hand and how I think she says not a cross, I think. And then he has to bring up that religious and sexual mania are closely linked. And it's another one of those nice things where Hitchcock just slams the church. You know, it's kind of, oh, okay, that's good. Yeah, I always appreciate that. But yeah, this is so interesting too, that we have dust coming through this movie quite a bit. We have the face, the makeup that left dust on the 10-pound note, and that's what's going to be used to convict him. But then we have the brush that was found that has the potato dust all over it, and that's what's going to help him realize that it's actually Robert rather than Richard.
I wonder how much of this came from Schaffer, because Schaffer was kind of quite obsessed with crime. And the bit when Russ takes the apple after he's killed Brenda, obviously there's a thematic thing, but also because you could match, they could match teeth then, dental marks, but apples, I always wonder if, and the same with the potato dust, I wonder how much this is from, because Schaffer wrote quite a lot about murder, and it seems so modern, the potato dust being this big clue in this pretty melodramatic story. It really bombs along as well. It really picks up the pace. You know, when he said, we just wait for Spearman to turn up, it really picks up pace then, yeah.
Yeah, because you do have the pretty, it's pretty rote, the whole thing of Richard faking and falling downstairs and being taken to a hospital, and you're just like, okay, he's going to escape and try to clear his name and try to put it all back onto Rusk and all this, and you're like, okay, that's pretty typical. And then you get the moment at the end when he goes up to who he thinks is Rusk sleeping, and he hits him with this tire iron several times, only to pull back the sheet, and there's another murdered woman with the tire on her neck. Again, to your point from earlier, Rebecca, anonymous woman. We have no idea who this woman is. She is as known as that corpse that was in the river, but here she is, and suddenly, like all corpses in movies, she becomes a problem. And you think for a brief second that now he is, looks like he's come back out of prison to murder again. But that's also the moment that the inspector shows up, and you're just like, oh, for God's sakes. But then thank goodness you hear this thudding off screen, and everybody's just like, what the hell is this? What is this thudding noise? And so when the door opens and Robert comes in with this huge trunk, thank goodness that they all realize what he's doing with that trunk. And when the trunk falls and thuds there finally in the credits roll, you don't need any more than that. You know everything's going to be okay, but we have lost some very great female characters throughout these proceedings that had to die in order to put this person away. But at the end of the day, Rob's going to go to jail and maybe even be executed for murder, but freaking Richard's still going to be a dick. I don't think he's going to be redeemed. I think he's still an asshole after this. So he's just going to go out there and continue to be that angry young man until he becomes an angry old man.
Yes. With a string of more failed businesses behind it. Yes. Yeah. And more disappointed women. Yeah.
It's a very nice way of ending this. And it does feel very similar to things that we've talked about, like with Rope, you know, where you just finally have to open that trunk before you can, you know, put things to bed in this. And you have those moments in at the end of Hitchcock films where you realize that things are going to be okay, but things are never exactly okay. Your main character might not be thrown into jail for the rest of his life. He might have a happy ending. He and even Marie Saint might go off into the distance. But, you know, like things like Marion Crane's sister, and maybe she hooks up with Marion's former boyfriend, but you don't know. You don't know what's going to happen with these characters.
And the end of the book is actually more disturbing, because he goes there and he hits the body and he takes the sheet off, and it's Monica Barling's secretary who's dead with a stock in her neck, and Rusk has gone. And yeah, so it has this very kind of, you know, this really haunting ending. This is the only thing I think that the book does really, really well, is that ending, because it's such a sort of shocking ending. But there's none of this sort of ironic happy ending you get in Hitchcock. Oddly enough, it feels more like the ending of a 70s movie, the book, than the one we get. But I agree. I think it works really well, especially with Mr. Rusk, you're not wearing your tie. It's the understatement. And I like that they give the last line to Oxford. I mean, I think he's really a great performance and a great character.
Yeah, and poor Oxford, he's going to go back home, and the next night he's going to have, what is it, duckling with cherry sauce, which actually sounds kind of good, but...
But you know what it's
going to
look like.
Yeah, it is going to look terrible. It's probably going to be, you know, a pinch of duck, and like the cherries will be all around it. Yeah. No, you're right. It's not going to be good. All right, we're going to take a break and play a preview for next week's show right after these brief messages.
Welcome to the future. The whole world is gasping for water, begging for mercy, and dying for freedom. no man can survive in this kind of world.
Ah, wait a minute. Ah, thing's too heavy.
But one girl can.
Bet your mind's bigger than yours. What? I'm practicing. Save the world. Finish my beer. Save the world. Finish my beer. Remember the girl next door? I ran her over. Die, 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 die! Hello? Is this thing on?
Tank girl.
Fabulous.
A word of advice. Lock up your sons.
I prefer to be on top.
Yes, we continue a rather eclectic month around here with a look at Tank Girl next week. Until then, I want to thank this week's co-hosts, Rebecca and Ian. So, Ian, what is the latest with you, sir?
I've got a book coming out in March, and it's called Kentucky Wild, the Films of William Girdler, and it's published by Bear Manor. So I'm quite excited about that.
And Rebecca, what's the latest with you?
Season 2 of my podcast Talking Hitchcock is launching this month, and my first episode's a deep dive of Dialing for Murder, with plenty more content coming across the year. I'm also busy working on commissions on Hostility and Hospitality in the 39 Steps, Nihilism and Nature in The Birds, and Mob Behaviour in Hitchcock's films. I'll be hosting some special anniversary screenings later this year up and down the country. That's the UK. So to keep up to date with that, the best way is to find me on socials at Pendle Pumpkin, and you can follow Talking Hitchcock at Hitch_pod.
Well, thank you so much, folks, for being on the show. Thanks to everybody for listening. If you want to hear more of me shooting off my mouth, check out some of the other shows that I work on. They are all available at WeirdingWayMedia.com. Thanks especially to our Patreon community. If you want to join the community, visit patreon.com/projectionbooth. Every donation we get helps the Projection Booth take over the world.
Our music, sir. Good night, sir.